With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, new almond export opportunities are beginning in the UK very soon. We'll tell you how soon coming up. But our top story today, the Environmental Protection Agency this morning is announcing the first national drinking water standard for PFAS. EPA Administrator Michael Regan.
From day one, President Biden directed his administration to take a whole-of-government approach to ensure that every community has access to clean drinking water, free from chemicals and pollutants that harm the health and well-being of our children, families, and communities. And EPA plays a central role in fulfilling that commitment. For decades, PFAS, or forever chemicals, have been widely used in industry and consumer products. They can be found in everything from nonstick cookware to cleaning and personal care products. There's no doubt that these chemicals have been important for certain industries and consumer uses. But there's also no doubt that many of these chemicals can be harmful to our health and our environment.
In addition to the legally enforceable drinking water standard, EPA is announcing nearly $1 billion in newly available funding through the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law to help states and territories implement PFAS testing and treatment at public water systems. It will also be used to help owners of private wells address PFAS contamination.
We listened to all stakeholders when crafting this rule: affected communities, bipartisan congressional allies, leaders at the state and local level, and utilities. The result is a comprehensive and life-changing rule, one that will improve the health and vitality of so many communities across our country. This rule sets forth clear timeframes for implementation, and we know it can be achieved using a range of available technologies and approaches that many water systems are using today.
EPA estimates that between 6% and 10% of the 66,000 public drinking water systems subject to the rule may have to take action to reduce PFAS to meet the new standards. All public water systems have 3 years to complete their initial monitoring for the chemicals. They must inform the public of the level of PFAS measured and where PFAS is found at levels that exceeded the standards. Then systems must implement solutions to reduce the PFAS in the drinking water within 5 years.
With today's action, we are one huge step closer to finally shutting off the tap on forever chemicals once and for all. Folks across this country deserve real solutions. They deserve clean air and water and a government that is committed to ensuring that they have access to these basic needs. In everything we do at EPA, from addressing PFAS to advancing environmental justice, we put people first. We're committed to fighting for every single one of you every single day. And we're not stopping until every person enjoys the same basic and fundamental protections.
EPA also has a National Water Technical Assistance Program to help small, rural, and disadvantaged communities access federal resources by working directly with water systems to identify challenges like PFAS. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. In today's National Spotlight, a 10-year-old USDA program is still delivering on its original promise of improving the environment on a larger scale. Gary Crawford has more.
Let's get into our time machine here and go back 10 years. It's May of 2014. Oh, look there. It's a press conference unveiling what was then a brand new Farm Bill conservation program, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, better known today as RCPP.
It does represent a watershed moment in conservation in this country.
This really is a landmark new conservation approach.
Wow, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, don't they look young back then? Of course, they're still with us today. So is the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. Vilsack told reporters a decade ago the idea was to have a program that would pool the efforts and resources of farmers and others, that it would be organized.
It will be integrated. It will be focused on large-scale watersheds and landscape-scale projects, which means that it will be even more effective than if we had simply spread $1.2 billion with individual producers in individual projects.
USDA still does individual farm projects, but the emphasis is on conservation on a large scale. USDA's Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Robert Bonney, told us.
So many of our conservation challenges don't exist just on one parcel of land. They cover an entire watershed or an area that might host certain wildlife or in order to be successful to reduce soil erosion, we need to work across a lot of different producers, a lot of different landowners. What this program allows is local partners to do exactly that, to work directly with NRCS and local producers to implement conservation practices and do it at a scale that can be really meaningful for whatever resource issue you're trying to address.
Last year, the RCPP helped local farmers and others begin work on 81 regional conservation projects with investments totaling about $1 billion. This year, it will be $1.5 billion, a new record high amount.
Most of the money is going to be targeted at climate smart agriculture and forestry, again, practices that can benefit production, agriculture, and forestry, even while we reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is all voluntary. It's all incentive-based.
And it's competitive. Under the RCPP, groups submit proposals for projects, and they compete for funding. For more information about the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, go online and search RCPP. That's RCPP. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
What can be done to control the spread of invasive pests and plant diseases that threaten crops, forests, and backyard landscapes? Rod Bain reports.
April is National Invasive Pest and Plant Disease Awareness Month, an appropriate time for this educational campaign. According to Catherine Bronski of USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, in that
April is a great time to get out and look for hungry pests. Trees are starting to leaf out, and it may be easier to see things in your backyard, your garden, as you're walking around in your community, as certain areas, these pests have not yet emerged. So if you're able to see them as their egg mass, you can easily find them, scrape them off, and smash them before they hatch. Remove them from things that may be in your backyard, like outdoor items, and actually be able to prevent them from hatching.
An example of what to watch out for in the way of an invasive pest, one that currently has federal quarantine areas within the northeast quadrant of the country.
You can look at your trees. If you find odd-shaped holes, kind of like a very small D-shaped hole in your tree, you might have emerald ash borer. If you look at your hardwood trees and see a perfectly round hole, a little bit smaller than the size of a dime, that might be an Asian longhorn beetle exit hole, and that tree could be infested with beetles. You can't really see them. They're all on the inside.
Eating the interior wood. When it comes to types of invasive pests, other examples include
spongy moth and other pests that harm trees and natural resources like our forests, and fruit flies, citrus greening, spotted lanternfly, and others that can damage crops in agriculture here in the U.S.
And regarding economic impacts associated to damages caused by invasive pest and plant species,
these invasive insects and plant diseases cost the U.S. an estimated $40 billion each year in damages to crops, trees, and other plants.
More details about Invasive Pest and Plant Disease Awareness Month, various threats, and ways to prevent them are available online at www.hungrypest.com.
We have lots of pictures and information on our website. If you go to hungrypests.com, click on your state tracker, and you can find specific information for your state, find information on what these pests look like, where they're located, and how to prevent their spread.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, animal disease experts are collecting a massive amount of data on the outbreak of avian influenza in dairy herds. Gary Crawford has more.
It started back in mid-March when dairy operators in Texas and Kansas began noticing some of their animals were showing signs of illness, which turned out to be avian influenza. On March 25th, lab tests confirmed the presence of highly pathogenic avian influenza in cattle from two dairies in Texas and two in Kansas. Since then, there have been confirmations of bird flu infections among cattle in Michigan, New Mexico, Idaho, and Ohio. That was as of this past Thursday, April 4th. Livestock disease experts are working to find out more about how dairy cattle are coming down with avian influenza. Dr. Rosemary Sifford with the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service told us.
It is really important at this time for us to receive information about these herds and receive samples from these herds so that we can get a more clear picture of exactly what's going on. And so we have epidemiologists who are working with producers to gather up information, and we're working with our state animal health officials to get samples into the lab for testing. All of that information helps us to understand much more clearly what role high path avian influenza is playing in this overall illness in dairy cattle and what we can do to more effectively prevent it in the future. And so looking at that data and those test results, we will continue to develop recommendations for producers for how to control and prevent the illness that they're seeing in dairy cattle at this time.
So far, veterinary officials are not putting mandatory quarantines around those dairies where some of the cows have contracted avian influenza. Dr. Rosemary Sifford also says right now there are no plans to depopulate cattle in herds with confirmed bird flu infections, and here's why.
So far, it appears that the cattle are able to recover after a couple of weeks, go back into the milking herd. And so at this point, we do not expect to need to depopulate cattle.
Dairy operators across the country are being asked to step up their biosecurity efforts and to watch their cows for symptoms of avian influenza.
The primary symptoms in dairy cattle are loss of appetite going off feed and then a dramatic drop in milk production. And some of the cattle occasionally show a slight fever.
If you see those symptoms in your herd, contact your vet right away. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
In other livestock news, the United States Department of Agriculture National Animal Health Monitoring System is seeking producers who have 500 or more ewes to participate in the NAMS study. This study is critical for the sheep industry in that information collected supports valuable research on important sheep health and management issues. Find more information on this from USDA's APHIS. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Beginning tomorrow, California almond growers will have some increased export opportunities in the United Kingdom. The UK has decided to suspend tariffs for at least 2 years on a variety of commodities, including raw kernel and in-shell almonds, starting April 11th. The announcement follows several years of collaboration between the Almond Board of California and the UK's Nut and Dried Fruit Trade Association. Since the UK left the European Union in 2021, 4% tariffs on in-shell almonds and 2% tariffs on raw kernels have been in place, while tariffs ranging between 8 and 20% on other almond products will remain in effect. UK trade officials are suspending tariffs on raw and in-shell almonds until June 30th, 2026. ABC plans to collaborate further with UK officials to assess the potential for additional tariff suspensions and boost demand for California almonds. The 2024 National Trade Estimate Report on Foreign Trade Barriers, released by the U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai, emphasizes significant barriers hindering U.S. ag exports. The report highlights challenges such as burdensome regulations in key markets like China and India, where agricultural trade faces hurdles due to non-science-based policies and slow approval processes for biotech products. The report also mentions issues with fulfilling commitments, as seen in China's failure to implement promised reforms. Additionally, the report underscores discrepancies in standards recognition, particularly in the European Union, impacting U.S. motor vehicle exports. Ambassador Tai stresses the importance of fair access for U.S. agricultural producers in the global market. The report's focus on returning to its statutory purpose aims to address these barriers and enable American farmers to compete on a level playing field. Tractor supply companies raised another $1 million to support national FFA chapters through its ninth annual Grants for Growing fundraiser. The initiative that ran from February 14th to March 3rd involved customers and team members purchasing FFA paper emblems in-store and online. Funds will aid middle and high school FFA chapters in developing project-based or experiential learning opportunities. The Grants for Growing Fund provides grants up to $5,000 in three focus areas: classroom enhancement, FFA chapter development, and ag literacy events. FFA advisors can apply for the grants through FFA.org/grantsforgrowing, with winners to be announced August 1st. Tractor Supply's overall contribution to the National FFA organization now totals $24 million, with nearly 1,800 grants impacting over 182,000 students. Growers looking to cut costs may consider adjustments to crop insurance. Assistant Cooperative Extension Specialist of Ag and Resource Economics with UC Davis, Brittany Goodrich, explains some federal crop insurance considerations.
Federal crop insurance, you can cover anywhere from the catastrophic coverage of 50% of your yield and price up to, I believe, 90%. And so the 90% policies are going to be a lot more expensive than the more catastrophic policies. And in fact, the catastrophic policies, they're very highly subsidized and charge, I think it's $655 per crop per county. So it's not even on a per acre basis. So that's a way, you know, if you drop down to that catastrophic coverage, it's a way for you to, you know, get some really cheap insurance, and you can even pay, you know, less than a dollar per acre for some of that crop insurance.
Stanislaus County Farm Bureau is hosting its 110th annual meeting of members in just a couple weeks. The event will feature a delicious meal, great people, and an inspiring message about perseverance. Director of Education and Communications with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau, Anna Genasi, highlighted the where and when for the annual meeting.
Thursday, April 25th is the day of the event. It's going to be held at the Turlock Fairgrounds. Tickets are only $65 a person. You can get a table of eight for $500. And if you're wanting to make those purchases, you can call Stanislaus County Farm Bureau. The number here is 209-522-7278. Or visit our website, go to the events page, and you can actually purchase your tickets online.
Genasi also noted what can be expected at the event.
So it's, you know, a meeting of members, but you actually don't have to be a member to come. Of course, we encourage you to join as a member. But our night includes a great meal, an open bar, a great trade show. Obviously, Amberly will be there speaking, but you'll also hear from some of our local leadership. So our outgoing president will kind of give his farewell. We'll acknowledge the incoming president. It's just a really great night. It's fun. There's fellowship, good food, and we can plan on a fantastic speaker.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The politics of climate change and how it's affecting farmers. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Researcher Dr. Margiana Peterson-Rockney says the topic of climate change is highly politicized in the United States, while it's not political in other nations. And she says the political aspect of the topic can cause difficulties for farmers.
And I have so many times been an hour or two into an interview with a farmer, and I'm asking about drought and wildfire, not using the term climate change. And they'll pause me and say, well, I know you're talking about climate change. And so, you know, I do believe in climate change. I know this is happening and we need to do something, but don't tell my neighbors, because I'll be ostracized in my community and lose access to these benefits of kind of neighborly reciprocity that people rely on. And so there are real social risks to taking action that's seen as climate action.
Many homeowners are unwittingly inviting raccoons to come into their homes and do damage. Gary Crawford has more on this edition of Agriculture USA.
It's radio quiz time once again. Yes, we'll give you some clues and you try to work out what animal we're talking about. First clue.
They'll eat just about anything.
Well, that could be any of us. Clue number two.
They're also pretty intelligent, so they're good at getting into things that we may not want them to get into.
Such as our garbage cans, or in my case, my attic. Let's see clue number three.
They're strong, too, and they've got those really dexterous front feet that are really shaped like hands and that they use like hands.
No. They cannot play the piano. At least I don't think they can. So what manner of creature are we dealing with here?
Now, somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon.
Yes, raccoons, the masked marvels of the animal world, who have a talent for causing havoc in the human world with maybe an assist from us humans. We'll find out how on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford.
Rocky, the rock and roll raccoon. He rocks his guitar, man. He's so cool.
Oh, that is some really bad music there, almost as bad as the damage that raccoons can cause. Drew Ricketts is a wildlife management expert, Kansas State University, and he says in his state they have an index system that tracks wildlife populations. And for raccoons,
that index has basically quadrupled from the late 80s up until the present time. And so we definitely have more raccoons.
Causing more problems for more people.
Both in urban areas and out in rural areas. It's a species that's more abundant and probably is causing more problems now than they ever have.
Especially in suburban areas where raccoons have fewer predators to reduce their populations.
And then, you know, we've also expanded our cities and suburban areas to occupy places that used to be raccoon habitat. And then within those cities, we've also had movements to create green space for people to go out and enjoy nature within the city. And one of the things that comes along with that is raccoons living right next to people in cities too.
And raccoons are quite adaptable and can get along quite well in urban and suburban settings. The problem is they can cause damage. A lot of it to homes, lawns, gardens. They can spread diseases to pets and even humans as well. But before we blame everything on the raccoons.
One of the really important things when we're thinking about dealing with wildlife damage is how we may be contributing to the damage that we're having.
For example, why did they pick my yard and my house and not the house across the street?
With raccoons, we oftentimes attract them to our yard with different things that we do.
Drew Ricketts says some of us unwittingly do things that say to the raccoons in the area, come on over to my house. It's great over here. One of those things is leaving food outside all day and night for our pets to nibble on.
Then it's only natural that a raccoon is going to try and take advantage of that.
Ricketts says leave pet food out only for short periods of time and then take it away.
I have a lot of people tell me, you know, well, I've tried that, but the dog wanted more. Well, it doesn't take very many days for them to learn that the food is only going to be out there for a certain amount of time. They need to consume what they're going to consume, and then you're going to put it away.
And another invitation to the raccoons to come to your place. Oh, those are weird-sounding birds. But it's bird feeders.
And if you're having raccoon problems, and if you have a bird feeder in the yard, and raccoons are eating that bird food, you're probably not going to get rid of your raccoon problem until you stop feeding the birds out there.
Ricketts says raccoons are not just looking for food, though. They'd like a nice, cozy home right there on our property. They love hollow trees, wood piles, open foundations under porches and tool sheds. And so the more we can limit things like that, the less chance of having problems with raccoons.
You're removing the food, cover, or water that critter is taking advantage of and that's attracting them to the yard. Also, taking care of your trash, making sure that raccoons can't get into your trash by having your trash cans secure and good tight lids on them and that sort of thing.
And so,
Rocky, the rock and roll raccoon.
Following Drew's advice may help keep the rock and roll raccoons from holding their concerts at your house. You've been listening to Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
He makes everybody rock out.
Trying to ensure that they make money off of lower crop prices, farmers may be tempted to cut back. An economist recommends managing costs instead. David Geiger has this report.
After years of crop costs ratcheting up along with fertilizer prices, the cost of corn and soybeans have dropped compared to last year. Farmers are looking at ways to cut back to turn a profit. That shouldn't be through reducing nitrogen, though, according to Chad Hart, a farm economist with Iowa State University. Farmers need to find the spot where they can save money while not damaging the yield.
Farmers over the last few years, they haven't used operating loans as much to avoid some of the interest charges that we face there. They've looked at utilizing more of their own labor as opposed to hired labor there. But yeah, for the most part, what you're doing is you're trying to manage those costs to try to keep them within check here.
A challenge with something like fertilizer, where prices remain historically high. Melissa Miller is with the Iowa Nitrogen Initiative. She's been researching how much nitrogen a crop needs.
The optimum rate varies from field to field by over 100%. This last year, we saw rates of optimum rates from 77 pounds of nitrogen per acre all the way up to 420. And even though that sounds high, that plant was taking up every last pound of that nitrogen. So there was really no extra loss to the environment.
Miller says the big question is why that is. The answer could make farmers more profitable.
Are there different management decisions we can make with tiling, with harvesting residue, with when we make that application that can bring that input cost down?
Outside of nitrogen, Hart says there are opportunities in some areas for farmers to beat the markets with basis.
One of the things I've been watching throughout this winter is, you know, we've seen the ethanol plants continue to maintain a stronger basis than some of our other outputs out there, and farmers have been taking advantage of that.
For farmers wanting a detailed look at their operation, Hart says Iowa State University has an estimated cost of production with Excel spreadsheets on its Ag Decision Maker website.
We've got an example form that shows you how we got the numbers we got. But we also allow you to put in your own numbers. So how much was your seed this year? So you can go in and adjust these budgets to fit your farm better.
I'm David Geiger reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. In this week's Almond Matters, brought to you by Valent USA, rotating chemistries is a critical component of a good fungicide program.
We're joined once again by Todd Berchtall this morning, Field Market Development Specialist with Valent USA. And Todd, let's just start out here this morning with just what's going on out in the orchard at this point in the season.
Things are growing now. The weather's starting to slowly warm up. It's cool at night, but then we've had that rain event like Friday. I think we got a third of an inch in Visalia. So all that moisture is part of that disease triangle. You got the environment, you got the host, you got the pathogen, you've got the disease. So again, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And typically after these rains, you need to, you know, re-protect or re-up your fungicide program. Because scab was a problem last year, rust was a problem last year, and alternaria was definitely a problem last year. And those three pathogens, and then you got whole rot too later on, but they're there and the environment's there. So you got to stifle that pathogen by putting out something that's going to impede its penetration and growth into the tree. And if it's already there, you're just going to stifle it from propagating itself, growing more. So it's a good time to put on fungicide, you know, something that works. Alternate. Alternation is the name of the game from a resistance standpoint and also just from an IPM standpoint. I'm a big proponent of IPM, you know, mix and match chemistries. Give them a punch to the nose and a kick to the shins, you know, knock them both ways. Be aggressive. Don't let up. Stay in the fight. If you let up, the opponent, the aggressor here, which is these diseases, will come back and eat your lunch and your breakfast and your dinner and all your crop.
And with so much disease pressure that was out there last year, if you really hit it hard, it might be maybe especially important this year to make sure you've got that rotation going, like you said.
Most of the PCAs that I know of, they rotate. You know, they rotate chemistries. You've got, you know, the different groups of classes of chemistry, which are based on groups, and those groups are based on mode of action. So you want to, if you're using a group 7, you don't want to repeat a group 7, you know, again and again and again. If you're with a group 11, you got a group 7 and a group 11 combination product, you know, you don't want to be repeating the same, even though it may be a different product, different AI, active ingredient in the combo, you don't want to use the same group 7-11 or group 7 or group 3 fungicide again and again and again, because you run the risk of resistance. Resistance is a real thing, you know, especially with anything with a high level of fecundity, which pathogens do. They produce millions of spores. I mean, it's been documented that the resistance can happen, especially when you don't manage it. Again, integrated approach, mix up your modes of action. You know, the labels are pretty specific about that. Every label out there, don't make more than 2 applications of this product before you rotate to a different group. Don't rotate with the same group number. For example, I'll use quash for an example. It's a product that's been around for a lot. It's a triazole, group 3 fungicide. You don't want to put triazole after triazole after triazole. And even though they're different chemistries, propiconazole, Orbit, Sevia, new one came out a couple of years ago, triazole. If you rotate triazole after triazole after triazole, you run the risk of creating that resistance issue. That happened back, you know, in the 90s with azoxystrobin. It was the only strobilurin out there, and it was used pretty broad spectrum. And then, you know, know, resistance became very real, pretty rapidly for alternarians. So, you know, and some of that's, you're up against the rock in a hard spot. You don't know, you can't, there is no other options that work. There's no other chemistries that work well. But be careful of these generics, because the generics products, they have the same, you know, same name. You got to look at the name and the group number. So if it's the same group number, don't rotate with that. Don't rotate with a different group number. You know, you got to be thinking not just about today, but tomorrow, next year, and the next 5 years. It's getting really difficult, Brian, to get a new AI registered with the regulatory environment, with the NGOs that want to keep all pesticides off of all crops. And in doing so, you know, anytime the EPA or EPR registers a product, they get sued. And so consequently, they make it more difficult to get a product through the system. It used to cost about $150 million. Now it's well over $300 million in about 12 years of testing to get things through. The products we use today are very, very safe because of that, but they were safe, you know, 20 years ago as well. The bottom line is rotation of chemistries is really key to keeping them viable as tools in your toolbox.
And now last year, California got just an enormous amount of rain, and there were some significant issues with disease. And so comparing that to this year with quite a bit less rainfall, what might the expectations be for disease pressures now?
I mean, you can compare year to year, but as far as disease pressure, if the environment is there, basically moisture, temperature, and you've got the host, again, it goes back to the disease triangle, the host, pathogen, and the environment. And if you take any one of those three things away, you eliminate the potential for a disease. And in our case, we eliminate the potential for disease by putting on a preventative fungicide, which takes out the pathogen or stifles the pathogen's infection and growth on the crop. And no matter if it's almonds or peaches or wheat or whatever, it could be anything. Any of those three things, you put a fungicide on, basically you're stifling the pathogen. So the key is rotating what you use to stifle the pathogen, and knowing your chemistries, knowing your tools, how they work, and then using them appropriately. Triazoles typically are locally systemic. Some of the strobilurins are more systemic than others. Azoxystrobin is more systemic. But there's also a dilution effect that takes place when you get systemic, but it goes throughout the whole plant. Some plants are highly, or some chemistries are highly lipophilic, and they bind to the outer cuticle of the leaves or the fruit, and they stay there. And, you know, some have preventative activity. Some of them have curative activity. Triazoles typically have a little reach back. They'll knock out the pathogen that's already infected. Some are contact. They only kill on contact. PhD is one of those. Works very well, but it's primarily just a contact fungicide. So knowing your chemistries, knowing your tools, how to use them, when to use them. Hey, I'm going to start out with, you know, a strobilurin or a mix of blended 7 and 11 product, like a Pristine or a Miravana or something like that, Luna. And then I'm going to come back with a contact, PhD. And I'm going to come back with a triazole, say quash. And then I'm going to come back with maybe another PhD. You create programs, and those programs are effective. They're effective to the level that you integrate them into your program.
We'll be right back. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. A coalition of farm groups this week urged Senate leadership to pass the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act. Michael Clement shares more on what the legislation provides agriculture.
The American Farm Bureau Federation and a coalition of agricultural groups are asking the Senate to pass the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act, which passed in the House of Representatives with broad bipartisan support. AFBF Government Affairs Director Dustin Shearer says the need is now.
There are a number of provisions in this bill that are important to the ag industry, and it needs to get done now, and that it can't wait until 2025. And so they need to find a way, whether or not it's voting on the bill as is or coming to a compromise on some of the provisions, and then moving forward, they need to find a way to get this bill done now.
Important to agriculture is Section 179 expensing and bonus depreciation, which is phasing down.
With that phasing down, 20% year over year, and the loss of your ability to buy and sell under 1031, farmers' tax bills are going up, and they're losing their ability to minimize their tax liability, invest back into their business the way that they want to, into this equipment that's helped them make their operations more efficient, more resilient, more sustainable, as they want to do and as the public wants them to do.
Shearer urges farmers and ranchers to contact their lawmakers.
They can reach out to their respective senators, whether through email or through a phone call, and have their senators urge leadership to bring the bill to the floor or to find a compromise bill and bring that to the floor and get this bill to the president's desk as soon as possible. It can't wait till 25. It needs to get done now.
Learn more at FB.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
The first U.S. drought monitor for April indicates decreases over time of drought coverage for most major crops and commodities. Rod Bain reports.
When it comes to areas of agricultural commodities covered by drought,
if you look at all major crops and commodities, we see pretty much across the board decreases from this time a year ago.
With USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey noting few exceptions, such as soybeans, barley, and sugar beets, seeing year-over-year increases in drought coverage.
Looking at winter wheat, our one very active crop at this time of year, just 18% of the U.S. winter wheat production area currently experiencing drought. That is down significantly from 49% of the winter wheat area in drought during the planting season last October.
Reflected in improved winter wheat crop condition ratings over the past 5 weeks. As for spring planted crop areas and drought coverage,
we see less than a quarter of the U.S. corn and soybean production areas currently in drought on April 2nd, 24% of the corn crop, 22% of the soybean crop that will be mostly planted in the next several weeks.
Down significantly from peaks of 70% of corn in drought, 63% of beans in drought in late summer.
Across the Deep South, only 8% of the U.S. cotton production area currently experiencing drought. That is down from a peak during harvest last year of about 50%.
Turning to the northern tier of the nation and spring wheat growing areas.
Currently, just 25% of the spring wheat production area in drought. That is down from a late summer peak last year of 59%. So you can see the trend there just for most major crops has been on a nice downward trend over the last several months.
Rippey adds the declining drought coverage trend also applies to commodities such as hay and cattle.
Should be a good year for hay production. Generally speaking, across the United States, 14% of the U.S. hay production area in drought on April 2nd. That is down from 42% last October. And then for cattle in drought, just 13%. That also down from last October's peak of 47%.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.